Before I hand it over to Kathy to introduce Kylie, we're going to take a moment of silence for the still suffering alcoholic, both in and outside of these rooms, and start with the we version of the Serenity Prayer. If we can have that moment now. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thy will, not mine, be done. And with that, I will hand it over to Kathy to introduce Kylie. Thanks for letting me be of service.
Thanks, Cynthia. My name is Kathy. I'm an alcoholic. I just want to say this has been one of the most inspiring weekends. You've had some phenomenal talks and some great people. And with all the stay at home, it's kind of cool to be able to bring this all into our home. You know, once in a while, you get a sponsee that just gets it and wants more and wants more. And she follows those suggestions and develops an enthusiasm for AA and uses the principles and builds a design for living. This wonderful woman has a God conscience in a joke, and I'm sure she's going to share it with you. God speaks to her through billboards and neon signs. So I know she's got a good connection with the man upstairs. She talks the talk. She walks the walk. I am so grateful she's a part of my sobriety. It's only been better since I've met her. I hope that you find her share as infectious as her laugh. And without further ado, I introduce you, Tiny Dancer, Princess Miracle, Rock Star, Kylie!
Woo, yay, Kylie!
Woo, yay, Kylie!
Okay. Hi, I'm Kylie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Kylie.
Hi.
Love you, Kylie. Lots and lots and lots. How much? Oh, bunches. Hoo-ah.
Whoa. Okay, thanks. Thank you. I love you too. Thank you very much. The disclaimers. First of all, I this Zoom thing is totally intimidating to me, as it is anybody else, I'm sure. Not that speaking ever isn't, but totally intimidating. And I not only said the prayer to be used as a vessel today, simply for anyone who might be new and might hear one thing, even if it's just that I'm sober today, that might be helpful. And the other thing is that I was asked not to swear, which is a big one for me. So I have asked God humbly to please, while using me as a vessel, if he sees fit for me not to swear, that would be really helpful. So we'll see. I think so far so good. I've not been swearing all day, like in practice. So we'll see what happens. Anyway, but now, you know, God has my tongue now, so I can't take responsibility for him. If you were here earlier this morning and you were here yesterday, or you were here through any part of the rest of this weekend. Oh, and then I forgot one other disclaimer. I just want to thank, Stacey and Marky and Cynthia and Mike, and Ashley for, the opportunity to be of service in this way, because it's a privilege and an honor to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous in any way, really. And this way too, you know. So in the meantime, while I wait for God to take my tongue, if you were here for any other part of this weekend, that is the part that you wanted to be at. This morning, there was a panel of individuals who, including June G, who was kind enough to facilitate it for us, who was comprised of, like 10 or 13 people who all got sober as teenagers. And I was simply overwhelmed and moved by the message that they shared. I can't imagine coming out into Alcoholics Anonymous without people like that who came before me. I can't imagine. And actually June is, I think, one of the first speaker, you know, it wasn't a tape. Okay. So, audio tape, if you will, MP3 tape that I ever had an opportunity to hear. I don't know that I can remember. And I was a year or 2 years sober when I heard it. And, two things I remember her saying, one of which was, that sobriety, well, one, that she got sober at 13 and I was 19 when I got sober. So to me, that was like, you know, something tangible, like hope that was tangible that I could touch and that I could hang on to. And then the other thing was that, that when she was about 7 years sober, she went to a wedding and she wore a brown dress and she had her curly hair. And, while she was at the wedding, she didn't hope to be anybody else. And she was good with wearing the brown dress and she was good with having curly hair. And 7 years at the time seemed like an absolute eternity. I didn't even drink for 7 years. But you know, it gave me a little hope, and my sobriety has not been a consistent series of years where I feel like I don't want to be anybody else. And where I'm really glad with what I'm wearing and I'm glad with what I look like and I'm glad with what I am and who I am. And, but I've had moments of that. I've had moments of that, which is a lot different than the person I brought to you when I was 19. So, what I'll do is try to share in a general way what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like now, or whatever God thinks is a good idea to share with you, I suppose. I grew up in Michigan. I live in Denver, Colorado now, obviously, but I grew up in Michigan. And gosh, the only things I really remember about growing up are the way that things made me feel. I was wildly selfish and self-centered from the get-go. I don't really remember what was going on around me. I don't really remember what the classrooms looked like and what the teachers' names were and, really like what my friends' names were. But I remember the way that I thought people made me feel. I remember the fear that I had, but I didn't know that it was fear at the time. I remember being so wildly discomforted by everything and living with this inability to deal with life on life's terms that was so powerful and overbearing. And I just, I just really wanted relief from that. That's what I remember. And, I thought that, before coming to AA, I thought that I had a uniquely dysfunctional household. And I came to AA and I stayed for a little while and I did an inventory and I started to hear other people's experience, strength and hope. And I found that, it's sort of a run of the mill dysfunctional situation, I guess. But my dad was the runner and my mom was the my mom also had challenges dealing with life on life's terms. We just didn't really know what the words were for them. And there were no real like formal diagnoses. I went to my friends' houses and I was able to look at their moms and see how their moms acted. And then I would go home and I would see how my mom acted. And it was very different. And I felt very convinced that I felt the way that I did and eventually, drank the way that I did and used other things in abundance and abused other things in abundance the way that I did because of the way that my parents were. And what I've come to find, thanks to some steps and some perspective from others, is that, I grew up in situations and grew up in a way where it was necessary for me to protect myself from what was going on in some situations and had to learn coping mechanisms for survival and learn some behaviors from them and adapted some fear there. But it's mine now. It's mine to deal with now. Like the longer that I spend pointing my finger at perhaps where I saw those things first, the longer I'm going to stay doing those things and really, really unhappy. I'm a kid. I'm growing up. I'm in Michigan. I'm wildly uncomfortable. I developed my first obsession before I found alcohol and other special effects, which was boys. And, I just would sort of like take turns picking I don't even know why I'm sharing this, picking the cutest boy in class and trying to get him to like me because I also learned as a kid very early on that my well-being depends on the approval of others. So, if there's one kid, which is why speaking scares me because there might be like 30 people who are nodding their head, but there's one person in the back corner who's not, and that's who's going to kill me. And that I just can't take that. I can't take that. I'm like a kid and if I have friends, I look for the one person who I feel like I'm not approved of by, and, I do everything I can to, win them over, really, I guess. And this becomes a pattern throughout the rest of my life. But I became deeply obsessed with people who made me feel better about myself. And I became deeply obsessed with fantasy too. I was like a dancer. I started doing ballet and taking ballet classes when I was like 3 or 4, and becoming a professional ballerina and becoming a professional dancer is something that's things that women in my family do. And it's something that I wanted to do too for a long time before I started drinking, because that kind of gets in the way of that. And I would, I trained with this Russian ballet company 6 days a week when I was a kid growing up. And I think I was in ballet class more than I was in school. And I love ballet because it was like this fantasy, and it was an opportunity for me to escape. And I forget who was talking about it this morning on the panel. I will do everything. You know, I did everything drinking wise and overabundance, and also in sobriety, I've done everything excessively, and I danced excessively, and I lost myself in that fantasy excessively. But I did, you know, I did really love it. When I was 13, I went to Sarasota and Florida, and I trained with the Sarasota Ballet Company. And then ultimately what happened was I found alcohol. And when I found alcohol, it was, you know, 100% a solution for the way that I felt. I did not see it as a problem. I saw it as an opportunity to be able to not feel the way that I felt, which was absolutely, you know, not right. I didn't even know that was like the age old question always. And like the thing that drove me just simply insane most days was I couldn't understand what was wrong with me. And I couldn't put my finger on what to do to fix it. And it wasn't as if when I started drinking and I had my first drink that I thought it was going to fix me per se, but I knew that it did something for me that I couldn't do for myself. Which is exactly linear to the experience I've had coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, actually. So I guess my first spiritual experience, if you will, was when I found alcohol. You know, and you know the feeling, you know, like I would take the drink and then it would get really warm and I just could breathe just for a minute though, because then I would overshoot the mark, you know, then I would way overdo it. And then now I'm not breathing at all anymore. Now I'm passed out somewhere. But before that, like before we get to that point, there's like a warm sensation and that ability to escape just for a moment, just very, very temporarily, is what I chased until it killed me spiritually and mentally and all that kind of good stuff. I never really had a social drink, and I don't really know how to do that. I see Kathy laughing a bit. I never had a social drink. It was very apparent that I had an abnormal relationship to alcohol as soon as it was introduced to me. I didn't like the taste, and you know, I didn't like the way it made my throat feel, I guess. And you know, I didn't like how I would get all out of control and dizzy, but at the same time, I felt like I couldn't stop when I started to do it. Like it would touch my lips and you know, what's funny is that I had, or not funny, and maybe it's totally normal because I'm an alcoholic, I started to have these tremendous consequences, or these horrible things would happen immediately, like being super, super young, and starting to drink, and these terrible things would happen. And disgusting things too. Like I, for some reason, I'm thinking of this time where, and I started drinking alone really early on too. Because once I started drinking, I couldn't stop drinking, and I didn't understand why. And I didn't understand why I would just find myself drinking all the time and find myself drinking so much all the time. But just, I did not know, of course, just like I didn't know I had this fear, and I had this God-sized hole that I live with, and I had a spiritual malady. I did not know that, I had a physical allergy and obsession of the mind. And that when I start drinking, there's nothing I can do about that. I'm in middle school, and then I'm in high school, and my drinking is really, really, really getting out of hand. I don't drink like the other kids do. And I can't, you know, I seem to not be able to manage it like they do. I can't just drink when there's a party on Friday night and then go home and sort of, you know, go on with the rest of my life or go back to school on Monday. I start drinking, you know, and then I don't really know. Maybe a few weeks later, I'll go back to school and maybe I'll go back to class. And, you know, I'm living with my dad and my stepmom at the time, and my dad would come downstairs and look in my bedroom and, you know, every once in a while, and I guess see if I'm there, and check under the bed and see that there are 55 bottles of liquor. And he fills them up in a hamper, in a laundry hamper. And he asks me, why are you this way? And why do you drink this much? And you're a kid. And I don't have an answer for him. I just know that drinking is sort of working for the problem that I'm having, which is I can't deal with how I feel. I cannot deal with how I feel. And like that in a nutshell, really is my story. And I probably have some stories that I could tell, I guess, about from my drunk log, but they're not really, I was thinking this after this weekend and listening to the other speakers. It's kind of all the same. You know, I drank like you drank, and I'm just like another alcoholic, and thank God. But I just, my relationship to alcohol is abnormal, the same as you and the same as me. And not only do I not want to stop when I start drinking and when I put something in my body that alters my state of mind, my state of being, I can't, and I don't know why. And, you know, I eventually graduate high school, sort of, kind of, I think, I don't know. I'm like a 1.3. I think I graduated. It's very questionable. I got a paper in the mail one day. So I think, I heard, so I'm miserable, and, you know, and I'm not dancing anymore. When I was 17, the drinking got so bad where I can't show up to dance class anymore. I was able to manage the drinking and the ballet and the dancing up until I was about 17. And then I just really can't anymore, because I can't show up for anything. I can't show up for school. I can't show up to walk upstairs because my room was downstairs in the basement and the kitchen was upstairs and my dad and stepmom's house. I can't show up to like get out of bed to go make myself food. You know, I'm wildly depressed and don't want to live anymore. But also don't have the courage to kill myself. But I think if I had, then I would have. I was watching a show once, and I don't even know what the show was. And this guy said that, and he lived in Los Angeles, and he was talking about, like, you know, his life of rock and roll, or probably that was very much my thing. He said that, you know, what I think is one day, God, or this, if there's a higher power, then he flipped the world over on its side and shook it a little bit. And all of the people as a result fell into the parts of the world where they belong. So if they belong in suburban homes, or they belong in the cities, and the people who don't have a place to fall or to land go to Los Angeles. So, when I was 17, I ran away to LA, and, I don't know if ever seen the movie Almost Famous, but I wanted to be like her. I wanted to be a groupie. And I felt like, when I think about it now, I like running off to Los Angeles at 17 was my last effort to, escape myself. I didn't know it at the time, but I was no longer finding relief anymore from the alcohol. I didn't know it at the time, but, my overwhelming sense of discomfort and disease and inability to live life on life's terms was becoming so profound, because I no longer was escaping myself with the alcohol. But I didn't know. It was like my body was continuing to get intoxicated, but I could no longer turn off my mind. And so I had one sort of, amongst many other things, there were a lot of things that went on in those years of drinking that I put myself and others in a lot of danger and a lot of risk, and put my life at risk at least once a day, in an effort to get drunk, because I will do anything to escape reality. I will do anything. I will go to places that, a 16, 17 year old girl, should not be going. I will put myself in situations that a 16, 17 year old girl should not put herself in. I will continually put my life in jeopardy because drinking is, you know, it's escaping reality. It's the only thing I know how to do. And it's the only way that I can maybe breathe for another couple hours if I know that I'll be able to do it again. So I ran off to LA, and the problem was that I was in LA too. I went there and then I was there. I went there and I didn't feel any different, you know? And, you know, there's like all these things, right, that I had like a fascination with, like Sunset Boulevard, and like I would see bands, and I would go and drink. I was 17 and I would go drink like in the Rainbow Room and stuff, which is like, I don't know if you, I don't know. It doesn't matter where it's just this place on Sunset Boulevard, it's this bar. And I would see really, really strange, interesting things take place there. And, but I'm not, you know, I can't escape for myself. And the only thing that happened there really was that I like died a little bit more inside, I guess, and put me in a place that where I really, I guess I started to give up. I didn't know what else to do anymore. And I ended up coming back home. And so in an effort to, speak only to the primary purpose, I will say, I refer to them as special effects. I went to treatment because I felt like I don't have an issue with drinking. I have an issue with these other things that people offered me in LA. I have an issue with these other things that, are really, really illegal. And alcohol is not illegal, even though I'm 17 and, you know, I don't even need, that goes without saying. But I go to treatment because I figure the problem is the toxicity of the things that I'm putting in my body. And I go to treatment and I'm the youngest one by far. And I spend the holidays in treatment and I don't stay sober. And, the only thing I found in going to treatment was that, I found other special effects for people to offer me. And, you know, it was clear if there had been an award voted on by the group for least likely to stay sober, I would have won that award. That's what I felt being there. I was very apparent that nobody there had any hope that I would stay sober. But what happened as a result of going to treatment is that they told me to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think they told me to go to like three a week, which I'm thinking now, it's so crazy because when I got sober, when I really got sober and stayed sober when I turned 19, I went to two meetings a day, every day, and I could have used more. So I don't know about three meetings a week, but they told me to go to AA. And I ended up through a series of events that I know is only a power greater than myself. I ended up in an AA meeting and I ended up meeting a woman who had also gotten sober fairly young, and she started taking me to meetings. I should grab my phone and watch the time because who knows? I don't know. God has my tongue at the moment. So I don't know how long he wants it for. So I go to AA and this woman is driving me, to lots of meetings and sitting in churches with me and reading the big book aloud to me. I don't know how much of it I would have even comprehended had I just gone off in a room by myself and read it alone. It probably wouldn't have been a lot. But what happened was I came to AA and I'm very good at, especially at the time, I'm very good at presenting myself in a way that will keep you at a safe distance from me. So I became sort of a mimic in AA, and I was this kid and I came in and I would gather all the things that people would share at tables, because in Michigan we sat at tables and 8 to 10 people would, you know, all sit together and share. And I would grab on to some things that people at the table would say, and then it would be my turn to share. And I would just regurgitate in my own way what you said, because that way you think I'm doing fine and you won't bother me. And you won't approach me and you won't get too close. And so I became like this sort of mimic in AA for a bit. And, but I don't know that I wanted to stop drinking, but I wanted the pain to stop by that point. I really, 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 really wanted the pain to stop. And so now I'm going to AA meetings and I'm seeing that people have hope, and that it seems like they have the same relationship to alcohol that I had. But I have not yet become transparent with how I really feel and the fact that I wake up every day and I don't really want to drink, but I do anyway, and I want to die. What happened was doing that and becoming a mimic in AA and not being transparent and just regurgitating the things that you're saying back to you in my own version, put me in enough pain to really ask for help. And I'm so grateful that the woman who was driving me to meetings at the time was driving me to meetings, and she was there and she was a connection. And so when I really was granted that gift of desperation and gave up, which happened on a Saturday night after I went to a Saturday night meeting, which later became my home group. And I don't know what was so special about the Saturday, but I went to the meeting. I regurgitated some things that you said. And then I went home and I drank. And I laid on my bed and I gave up. And I don't really know why. I really don't know why. There are nights that I spent far more, dangerous and interesting than that. That's a pretty underwhelming one. It wasn't one of those nights where I was walking around in downtown Detroit and in parts of the city where they don't have streetlights and I have like no clothes on and I'm walking around and looking for an ATM that doesn't exist at a gas station that doesn't exist to try to pull $20 more out of a debit card that doesn't exist so that I can get a little bit drunker, so that I can get a little bit more further into oblivion because I can't deal. And now I can't stop drinking. I don't know that, but I can't stop drinking. Now I have no choice. So I asked this woman for help. And of course, she is a member of AA and had been sober 5 or 6 years at the time. And so she obliged. And the next day, she took me through the first 3 steps. And I don't know if... and then she assigned me my sponsor, which was good. Thank God I was assigned a sponsor right away, because if someone had told me, like, find someone who has, you know, what you want. And what I wanted was really sick and really kind of twisted. So I would have asked like Axl Rose to sponsor me or something. I wouldn't have, it's really good that nobody told me to do that. And also, I would have still been shopping years later for a sponsor. I would have still been, I don't know what she has and I don't know what they have. And, you know, and everybody to me is different at the time. And my insides don't match your outside. So I don't know. How do I know? I don't know. So I'm assigned a sponsor. Thank you, God. And thank you to her who did that. I was sort of, you know, launched on the course of rigorous action and taken through the first 164 pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sense of urgency. It wasn't the weekend, the 2 days that it used to be, but it was the first time through was pretty quick. And I know that everybody has their experience. I just know what my experience was. And I know that if this woman had not grabbed me and taken me through the work as quickly as she did, I wouldn't be talking to you tonight, offering my tongue to God. Like, I wouldn't be here, that's for sure. I really, 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 really was sick. And thank God I was really desperate enough. And I needed a solution really quickly. I needed a sufficient substitute really quickly. Normally I share what my experience was like going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they're laid out in the big book. But we've gotten such a good display of that this weekend. We've gone through every step and like my experience is exactly, I could regurgitate to you, which is, I don't really do that anymore, but I could regurgitate to you everything that everybody has shared this weekend. And it's essentially what my experience has been with the steps. I did them far from perfectly. The only one I suppose I did perfectly, as it said, is the first step. I I struggled for a long, I struggled for a while when I was new. And in the first 6 months that I was sober, am I an alcoholic? Am I too young? I'm 19. You know, was it my parents? Was it the fact that I did a lot of my drinking and using with my mom? Is it because I wasn't protected from these things? Is it because of what I saw? Is it because of what I didn't see? Is it because of what I didn't get? I have found that, you know, again, I was left with some things to deal with, in response to the way that I grew up, in response to some things that took place. But, I am, as, Minnie M says, I am alcoholic to the bone, man. You put a drink in my body, and it's going to be an issue. It's going to be an issue. And not only can I not stop, I make a decision to do it over and over and over again while I'm sober. I made every drink I picked up while I was sober initially. So, you know, why do I keep doing that? And I got to examine that in the first step, and it took me a while for sure to, I didn't, struggle with the idea of unmanageability at all. It was more or less, I didn't understand the relationship with powerlessness that I had between myself and alcohol. And what I've come to find is that, like I will drink, I'm the kind of alcoholic I get, you know, I will drink no matter what, again, without a sufficient substitute, which is what the 12 steps and the fellowship of AA and a power greater than myself has offered to me. And it really is true. It's my experience that I had no conception of a God. And so I am one of those that took a lot and held on tightly to work the steps and you'll be contacted. And I don't know when that happened. And I don't even know. I just took action imperfectly, but as perfectly as I could and within my human limited ability, and did the things that I was told to do. The only suggestion I didn't follow was to not get in a relationship in the first year. I was in a relationship by the time I was 3 months sober. I wanted what he had. He had 4 months of sobriety at the time. Again, I won't go through the steps, I guess, but, I'll share, I suppose, what I'm like now, which I don't know. I think would be better is for this portion about what I'm like now, if I just turn it over to my sponsor, because she could probably more accurately tell you what I'm like now. I don't know. I don't have an accurate perception of myself, but I know the way that I experience life now, I suppose. I just have my experience, and my experience in life now is wildly different. It's wildly different, and there have been a lot of really, really wonderful things that have happened as a direct result of getting sober and as a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous, but also there's been a lot of really painful stuff too. Really, really painful stuff. There have been times in sobriety where it's hurt so bad. I think, you know, this is it. There have been no drink worthy events, and I've never had an event where I think this is when I'm going to drink. And when the really painful stuff has happened, I never think this is when I'm going to drink. I think this is going to do me in, and like do me into the nut house is what I think. This is going to be, and it's just, actually, it's exactly like Pat was talking about earlier with the 11th step. I get so scared when the pain gets so great that there's no God, because I know that when the pain gets so, so overwhelming in that way, I don't have the power really to relieve myself of it. I know I just have to like to keep showing up. I was talking to my sponsor earlier today, and she brought up this idea of the miracle of persistence. And honestly, there have been times in my sobriety where it's about just being persistent and just hanging on and still doing the next right thing and continuing to show up, even though it's so painful. And one of those times actually was a couple years ago, that relationship that I got into when I was all of 3 months sober and thinking that, you know, well, he has 4 months sober, so he's wiser than me anyway, so it's a good idea. You know, I and thank God we'd both worked the 12 steps by that time. And so thank God when after 4.5 or 5 years of being together, it certainly was not a drink worthy event, but our separating was, it was extremely painful because I had cloaked myself in this identity of being this person's partner. And we sort of did this Mr. and Mrs. AA thing. And I could hide behind that for a long time. And I didn't even know that, you know, the way, like when I was a kid and the way that I've always gotten lost in things and just enveloped myself in things so that I don't have to deal with how I feel and I don't have to just feel the reality of my own life. I did that in this relationship unknowingly for years. I did not know, but I knew when we separated. I really knew then, because the pain was really, really great, and I had to totally this morning Chip was talking about having to sort of surrender over and over again. And different points in his sobriety where he's had to sort of like give up, surrender, and seek again, all over again. And I've had to do that a number of times. So what's more important, really, is that I tell you about some of the miracles that have happened, which usually if you ask me, and like earlier, I was having this conversation with my sponsor, and I said, I don't think any miracles have happened in my sobriety. I'm sorry. I don't think any miracles will be happening. I've experienced and maybe strength, but I don't know about miracles. She gave me a few just to start brainstorming. And I prayed about it and I came up with a few that came to mind. When I was in my first year of sobriety, I'm going to guess I was maybe 6 months sober, but my perception of time is really distorted and kind of funky. So I think I was like 6 months sober. By that time I had started painting. I just felt so incredibly intensely when I got sober, and I didn't know what to do with these feelings. And I used to think like, oh, I feel things so deeply. Which is true. And my feelings are always hurt and I'm emotionally sensitive. Well, I'm really emotionally mature and I can't, you know, everyone has hurts my feelings and everything affects me in a way that's like, it's obscure. And so I start painting because, I'm trying now not to react the way that I used to react. I'm trying now to like implement these new ideas and pause when agitated or doubtful. So I paint. And also because I would live in AA meetings all day. And then at 3 a.m, it's not, you know, I didn't want to call people and wake them up at 3 a.m. that I'm still like going insane and hanging onto the carpet, just trying to like get through another 24. So I would paint. And when I was like 6 months sober, it was encouraged that I participate in this art show for some reason. And I don't know what I'm doing. And, you know, I don't even really know how to paint. I'm just doing it as a way of expression, I guess. So I paint all these things or whatever, and you know, naturally I'm like, okay, I'll show up. I've now learned how to show up. Just show up. I'm scared to show up, but sobriety for me is just a series of showing up to things I'm scared to do and scared to things I'm show up for. Or show up to things that I'm scared to show up for. My sobriety is just a series of, do it when you're scared. And I was real scared, but I showed up because, you know, people in AA probably told me to, and my sponsor at the time probably told me to. So I showed up, and then I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be fine because, nobody else is going to show up and nobody's going to buy any of my paintings. So I won't have to interact with anybody. And what happened was I had been in AA for 6 months and I'd been going to meetings, and these people had, brought me into their lives and their homes in a way that I was becoming family with them. And so I sold out of all my paintings, not because my family of origin or my family of blood showed up, but because people of AA showed up all day and they bought all the paintings and I had none left. I don't know what I did with the money. I probably bought a lot of cigarettes at the time. I don't know. Thinking about myself getting sober in my leather jacket, I probably bought a lot of Marlboro Reds. I don't know. I would like to think I did something more responsible with it. When I was about a year and a half sober, I got this really crazy idea that I should take a class at a community college, which I don't know if you knew me when I got sober and knew sort of like this punk 19-year-old kid attitude that I had, going to school and participating in a classroom situation was not ever going to be my deal. That was like, you know, A, not cool, and like too like regular of a thing to do. I didn't understand how people did that. That was one of those things that I would sort of watch from inside and watch other people do things with their life, like graduate from high school and then go to college. And I didn't understand how people put those puzzle pieces together at all. So I got this crazy idea and I took a class at a community college, like one class maybe. And Kathy encouraged me to do it. And so I did it. And AA by then had taught me kind of like how to show up for these things. And I showed up on time and I learned how to turn my homework on time. And this really weird thing happened. At the end of my time, at the local community college where I was taking classes, there was this like program for speech. I had to do this like speech class thing with a bunch of kids at the community college in order to like progress on, because eventually I transferred to Wayne State University from the community college. And we had to vote. There was this election and we had to vote for like the student who we felt was most likely to be successful in their career. So I just want to remind you of how I like came in fresh off the plane from LA, like wanting to be Stevie Nicks and whatever. Not because of things that I've done, but just because of, I'm just giving you proof of AA. Like all I'm giving you is proof of AA and that the 12 steps worked. Not because I'm not that I'm special or not that I have these great abilities. It's really, 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 and truly not that. I just feel like I need to preface by saying that. I won an award there, or my peers or whatever have voted me to be the most likely to succeed in a career, which I don't even know still what the career is that I'm succeeding in, but that happened. And I know that I'm like now using a lot of time somehow. So I'm going to finish with these miracles and then sit down and shut up. When I was four and a half years sober, I got a phone call that there was a girl. My parents were best friends with this other couple, and they sort of grew up together and did everything together. And then they had myself and they had their little girl within a month of each other. So, and we had no siblings for a long time. We were both the oldest of four. So when we were both born, we were sort of born and given to each other as siblings. And her parents at times of my life were more of my parents than my own parents were. And her mom was like my mom, and her grandma is my grandma. And I got a call that from my mom that I didn't answer because I was really stuck in self in that morning. And then I got a call from my dad, which seemed strange. So I answered and he told me to put on some clothes that he was going to pick me up. And he said, there's been an accident and Shelby was in it and she died. I don't know what to tell you. Just, I'm going to come pick you up. You're just going to be here. You're just going to leave. You're going to leave and we're going to go. I was living in a condo at the time in Northville with my then boyfriend. And he picked me up and, you know, again, I thank God I didn't even, the thought of drinking was not, I've never had the thought of drinking in response to any of these things. And there have been a lot of things, honestly, I've never had the thought of drinking in response. So I learned by that time in my sobriety not to make every situation about myself. So what I got to do the week that Shelby passed from the car accident was spend every day, all day, being of service to her family. And they wanted a eulogy, so I gave the eulogy. And my mom, who I didn't even talk to really for the first few years of my sobriety, who I had this tremendous, massive, overwhelming resentment towards before getting sober, and quite frankly, for years into my sobriety, my mom and I planned the funeral together. And I think Shelby did that really. I've been able to have some different service positions in AA. And so I've sort of learned how to be of service and, you know, and how to like participate in a committee. Shelby studied, was the head of this research program at Oakland University for post-traumatic growth and studied psychology, and had graduated 2 weeks before she died, and was in the business of helping others. And so her family decided within the year after her passing that a foundation should be started in her honor to carry on the way that she helped other people and to carry on the work that she started. And so I'm on the board of that foundation, and I get to show up to those board meetings the way that I learned how to do in AA, the way that I learned how to do service and have different service positions in AA. You know, and I'm just trying to watch time. There's other stories associated with this, but I'm trying to watch my time and be mindful of that and respectful of that. When Shelby and I were little, on Mother's Day, we wanted to give her mom something really nice, but we were kids and we had no money. So we thought it was a really good idea. I should probably make amends for this. We thought it would be a good idea to go to the neighbor's house and rip all the flowers out of their front yard so that we can present them to her mom as a Mother's Day gift offering, like, here you go. And there were this next door neighbor had all these really, really beautiful tulips and this really beautiful garden. And so we proceeded to, by then our younger brothers had been born. And so we pushed her younger brother's stroller down to the neighbor's house and filled it up with tulips and then and then pushed it back over to her house and laid out all these tulips. And this was like our, you know, Mother's Day offering at this poor neighbor. And then, you know, when we were instructed to go return them, Shelby threw them on the neighbor's porch. I should go. I know where they live, actually. This was a couple years ago. I was getting ready to speak at a meeting in Northville, Novi area, back in Michigan. And totally self-centeredly, you know, nervous and scared. And because I think it has something to do with me, I think that speaking has to do with me and the way that people are going to think of me. And it has absolutely nothing to do with me. And I was living in a condo with my then boyfriend, and I looked out in the back, and I just want to tell you that I never planted flowers in the back. I never did anything like that. I'm not Susie Homemaker. Like, I don't know how to do anything like that. And I noticed that there were flowers that were blooming from the backyard, and they were tulips. And I'd never planted them there, and I didn't put them there. But I remember going then to speak that morning or the early afternoon, I think, and just standing behind the podium and saying, I just have to tell you, if it weren't for AA, I wouldn't have a backyard to look out at, and I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't have a window to look out at, and I wouldn't have... I don't think I would have remembered that story, and there wouldn't be tulips like that. And you know, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to be of service to my best friend's family and my second family in the way that I've been able to in sobriety. The relationship that I got in when I was 3 months sober, like I said, we parted ways, and the miracle there was that we parted ways and being really good friends, and years later, we're still really good friends. I know now that we had done all the growing that we could do within remaining in that relationship. I didn't know it at the time, and I wouldn't have signed up for it had I known, but I had a lot more growth to do just within me, myself, and I that had stopped happening because I was in the relationship. I developed a love for hiking in sobriety, which is hysterical because I wouldn't go out of the house really before I got sober and for the first couple years of sobriety. I did not like being outside, and nature was not appealing to me. And I totally fell in love with hiking, and the great outdoors, GOD, in sobriety, and started, taking hiking trips every October, every fall. And, last year I was going to, quit my job. And, the week that I was going to quit my job, I got an opportunity to be transferred within the company that I work for to move to Denver, Colorado. I'd never been to Colorado, but now I'm living in Denver, Colorado. Before I fail, just, I guess, tell you a couple more recent things. Recently my grandfather passed away. The virus that we're sort of all, you know, the reason we're on Zoom because of COVID-19, my grandfather, I got a call one morning about a month ago, that, then my grandfather had the virus, and by the afternoon we found out that he was going to pass and not going to survive as a result. And so the miracle there is that I've been able to be there for my grandma in a way that I never thought was possible. That's for sure. And also, so where I'm at now, currently, I guess, is I'm living in Colorado, and I found out a week ago that I'm losing my job. Yay. Yeah, so I'm losing my job, and the company I work for is essentially can no longer survive. And, you know, I panicked right away, because I believe in those moments, not that God is big enough to deal with that, and not that God has brought us far enough not to drop us on our heads. But I think, okay, this is when I need to take control. And this is when I need to like get in the driver's seat, and I need to make something happen that is not happening, because I'm really in trouble. And I don't have the ending to that story yet. I just know that, that like my sponsor said to me earlier, I've been given the miracle of persistence, and sobriety has offered me the miracle of, continuing to show up in spite of myself, and continuing to, do the next right thing when I don't want to, and when I'm really, really scared to, and continue to show up and participate in my life when I'm really, really scared to. And right now I'm really scared to. I'm really scared that I'm not going to find another job in time, and that I'm, you know, not going to be able to live where I live anymore, and then I'm going to go back to Michigan, and I guess it's really not a bad deal. If that's what happened. If that's the worst thing that could happen, that's really not a bad deal. I come from a place in time where I never put myself in a position to get any of the things that I have now that I have problems with. I was totally unemployable when I came into AA. I didn't have a job for a while. And then when I did, I had to really learn how to show up every day. I would have never imagined that I would have a place to live that was my own, that bills were sent to, that had my name on them. Oh, I remember the first time I ever bought Lysol years ago, and I told my sponsor that I bought Lysol, and I was using Lysol like that. I mean, I don't know. I'm not the kind of chick like that came in here at 19 that was going to buy Lysol and do anything with it. You know, I that's just not how I brought you. So anyway, I think it's been an hour, and if you heard nothing that I said, that's totally fine. What I really want to say is that if you're new, please just like hang on for 5 more minutes. Please just hang on for 5 more minutes, because, like so many have said today, Alcoholics Anonymous has not given me the life of my wildest dreams. It's given me, beyond a life of my wildest dreams. And so thank you for saving my life and for all the things that I really, really would have missed. And with that, I will shut up. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Kylie. Wow, you are truly incredible. I'm so grateful I got to hear you and your grace and humility and humor. So thank you so much for that. That was incredible. Let's end this meeting with a moment of silence followed by the third step prayer. If we can have that moment now. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much, Kylie. It's been an absolute pleasure to get to know you in this quarantine. I'm just overwhelmed with your story and your passion for life. So thank you for being my friend and for being a part of this committee and for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. So some last minute announcements. Again, thank you, Kylie, for speaking. I do want to thank the committee, Stacy, for Ashley, Cynthia, Kylie, Mike, and Bunny, who has been our tech guru this entire time. If you do like what you've heard, everything that you've heard this weekend is available on recoverytapers.com. It does start at 2:39. We do believe in the seventh tradition, which states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. Today's seventh tradition will be contributions to the GSO.